Hey everyone, it's me, Reed Galen. As you may have noticed, I don't host the Lincoln Project podcast anymore, but I'm so excited to share with you my brand new show, The Homefront. On The Homefront, you'll get the same incisive discourse about the pro-democracy movement from the smartest, most driven people in the fight today. If you're listening to this episode on the Lincoln Project podcast channel, I invite you to subscribe to The Homefront on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. I want to say thank you to all of you in the pro-democracy movement, and I look forward to continuing our American journey together. And now, The Homefront. Hey everyone, before we get started, I need you to go to jointheunion.us and sign up to volunteer today. I'm on my way to North Carolina as you're hearing this, and I'm going to be in Michigan next weekend. We'll be in Arizona and Wisconsin before Election Day. But guys, we need your help. Jointheunion.us. Volunteer, you can do it from your house, you can come out to a polling place, you can do whatever it is. And if you want to keep this mission on the road, you can also contribute a few dollars, which we would certainly appreciate. Go to jointheunion.us and get involved today. We will do this, gang, but it will take all of us. And now, on with the show. Welcome to The Homefront. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by Joanne Carducci. You might know her as JoJo from Jurors. Jo is a political commentator, digital creator, and social media sensation. She has just passed 1 million followers on Twitter. She is the author of the Are You Effing Kidding Me Substack newsletter and also hosts a podcast of the same name. Today, she's coming to us from the Garden State. Jo, welcome.
Thank you so much, Reed, and greetings from the Garden State.
So, 5 years ago, did you think that you'd be where you are, in the middle of the political fight, being invited to the White House on a pretty regular basis, being invited to campaign events by the Vice President of the United States, traveling, you know, mostly the Northeast Corridor, but all over the place? Like, 5 years ago, would you have believed that you would be someone to whom millions of mostly left-leaning voters look to for insight, experience, entertainment? I mean, would you have imagined that, you know, in 2019?
No. In 2019, full disclosure, I did not imagine being alive in 2024. Like, my life was bad. It was dark. I was depressed. I was lost. I was really struggling and sort of living this suburban existence that just felt like perpetual sort of mundacity. It was just a really bad time for me. And I didn't envision anything but myself. Honest to God, this is going to get dark for a second, but I promise there's an upside because here I am talking to you. I imagined myself, you know, running into a telephone pole. So that's where I was at 5 years ago. That's how bad things were for me. But then, you know, something snapped in me about fighting Donald Trump. And I would say they weren't that bad in 2019. Actually, it was more like 2018 when things were really, really bad for me. But Donald Trump's awfulness sparked something in me where I felt this personal compulsion to stopping that bully, to proving to my kids that the bad guy doesn't win, that it started forcing me to get out of that dark place and come back to life. And that his awfulness brought me back online and then gave me a purpose I didn't have before, that has been feeding all of this ever since. And I think because it's a true extension of who I am, what I want to leave behind for my kids, I won't stop. But also, I'm shocked constantly by what my life looks like now versus what it looked like then. I mean, it's as different, other than the fact that I love my kids and I have my kids all the time, it's as different as it could possibly be.
Well, I can only imagine in that sort of, yeah, skyrocketing from as you said, normalcy. Right. What you had was a difficult, from what it sounds like, but, you know, all things considered, you know, an experience that so many people that we're listening to have gone through themselves, especially that sort of suburban day in, day out, get up, get kids to school, do this, do that. Right. Worry about, you know, am I going to pay this bill? Am I going to pay that bill? How am I going to do this? What am I going to do, to your point, for the kids? And so something snaps in you, and, you know, you are, and this is one of those things, just to make it about football, because I know that you're an enormous football fan.
I do like football.
Back in August, Hard Knocks, which is an HBO show, does a different team every season. And this year they did the Chicago Bears. Why, I don't know. And Nick Saban, the former coach of Alabama, legendary college football coach, comes to the Bears training center. And they're talking about the kid that's the Bears rookie quarterback. And they said, you got to look after this kid. He was in college in L.A. Now he's in Chicago. He's making millions of dollars. He's got this enormous pressure on him. And what Nick Saban said to the coaches, and you got to remember, 99% of the world just wants to get through the day. 99% of the world doesn't want to stand out. 99% of the world is just trying to survive. And what you're asking this kid to do is be far more than that. You're asking him to be the 1%. And so I think, Joe, the reason I bring up an anecdote not at all related to you is because the normal human nature thing is to say, how can I make a difference? Why would it matter if I do this? But I think that you are living proof of the idea that, yes, if you are driven to a point where you say no more, right, not one step back, and you stand up rather than, you know, moving out, that you can, in fact, make a difference. And so, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, look, I don't fault anybody for any action they take unless it's just patently immoral or amoral. But the idea of saying, okay, you know what, here I am sitting in this place. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do something. And now, as you said, 5 years later, here you are. So talk to us about the first time you get a call from the White House to say, hey, we'd love to come see you.
I mean, it was 2022, I guess. Yeah. And I mean, I was still working in education at the time. I was a paraprofessional for autistic preschoolers. So I was, you know, certainly not living the White House visiting kind of life. And the invitation came via email, and I thought it was spam, of course. Like, I was like, oh, the White House is inviting me, right? Oh, it's spam.
There's also a Nigerian prince that had some money for you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And my money tree in my backyard, I was just going to go out and start picking hundreds off of it any minute. Yeah. No, it was, so I saw it and I kept scrolling. I was like, oh, that looks like spam. I'm not going to open it. And then I kind of like thought about it for a little bit, and I went back and I was like, maybe I'll just open that. What could that possibly be? And when I did, it was, you know, now they do the email version of the beautiful ornate invitation. And it was an invitation from the White House to attend an event. I think that one was commemorating the Inflation Reduction Act signing. And I just started screaming. I was like, this is real. I called everyone I knew. As soon as my kids got home from school, I was screaming, excited, jumping for joy, pinching myself. I could not believe it was true. But it was. And what was even crazier about it was when I went, obviously, you know, I went, it was about 2 weeks later. I woke up that morning in DC and I had the weirdest feeling. I was like, I feel like I'm going to meet Joe Biden today. I just woke up and I had the weirdest feeling. And I sent that out into the universe. And I went to the event. We got there early. I was sitting like two rows from Pete Buttigieg. And then I did. I got to meet Joe Biden for the first of two times that day. Right. And I cried like a baby. Oh my God, did I cry like a baby.
So tell us a little bit about how you got started. So was it just you started you have a very, what I would say, particular brand on Twitter.
Are you saying I swear a lot?
You and the F word, I think, are best of friends. You paint with the F word the way Picasso painted with, you know, with acrylic, right?
Thank you. That's a high compliment, Reed.
It is. So tell us a little bit about how you came to this, because so much of this, too, is, you know, there are PR firms all over the country, marketing firms all over the country, Joe, who like they're trying to quote unquote like create voices. But what we've seen is whether or not it's with you or with my old colleague Keith Edwards or Brian Tyler Cohen, who I just had on the show last time, that a lot of this stuff, you either got it or you don't. That social media has a very particular idiom in which it works. And each of them are different. Yeah. Right. Like Twitter has a very particular thing. Instagram has a very particular thing. So how do you do that? One, how do you find the time for it? This is a question I asked Brian. But second, how did you decide like this is who I was going to be? Or is that who you really are? Are you really dropping F-bombs all the time?
Yeah. No, this is me 100%. And that includes the F-bombs, as my kids will tell you, because now they drop F-bombs all the time, which is great. But it's Jersey. I mean, that's like, you know, that's, you have to do this requisite here. You can't drive in New Jersey if you're not swearing at people. Like, it's just, they're going to run you off the road if you don't call them F-bombs. Or, I don't know if I can swear on this, but I do swear.
You can. We'll bleep you out.
All right, thanks. Yeah. I mean, my podcast and Substack are called Are You Effing Kidding Me? I mean, it's like, it's just, it's just part of who I am. But the other part of what you asked, though, is this is the thing that I think it is this is who I am. And I don't see any utility. I never have seen any utility in trying to be something I wasn't. When I look back again, that question you asked at the top about who I was and where I was a few years ago, I was feeling stifled and silenced and like I didn't have a voice in this world, and I'm not inherently that kind of a person. So I was really lost for that reason. So when I got out of all of that and I'm here now and I've worked my way to this point, there is no way I'm not going to use my authentic voice. Like that's what I have something to say. I have a lot to say, and I'm just going to say it in the way I would say it if you were sitting in front of me. And if that is something that resonates with people because that's the way they think or the way they talk, then that's what it is. But I'm never going to be somebody I'm not. I just don't see the point. And people tell me that I say things that they would say or that they would think or that they appreciate. And because I'm just as real as I can possibly be. So I think that's the key for me anyway.
No, and I think, again, that authenticity, right? I mean, look, humans can spot a phony a mile away, right? Some people can fake it for a while, but it's really hard to be that fake for that long. So let's talk straight politics a little bit, and let's bring it to your world as a political commentator, as someone who, again, has a million followers, millions of people listening to you. So the other day, Donald Trump tweeted something about the fact that when he's elected, he'll protect women. Then he said something similar again in a speech. And you had a pretty, you know, stout response to that. But give us a sense when you hear and see him doing that after not only a lifetime of bad behavior, but after 9 years of him coming down the escalator, two and a half years since the Dobbs decision, the Alabama decision on IVF. Give us a sense of what that means to you personally and why it fired you up so much, aside from the obvious.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, he's a bully. He's a bully. He's a predator. He's a bad guy. He's an abuser. I mean, there's a million trillion data points now. We know that that's who he is. We've known it since he came down that escalator. So, you know, what bullies and abusers do, what abusers do, is they gaslight their victims, right, into believing that what they're experiencing, they're not experiencing, or what they're feeling, they're not feeling, and that they're the only ones who can keep them safe or protect them. And they have to do these things that are uncomfortable or abusive or violent in that end, to that end. He's not successful at gaslighting anybody except for the, you know, devotees and like the deep, you know, MAGA cultists into believing that he'll protect us. Like no one who heard that was, you know, still firing synapse in their brain was like, yes, of course, that's a logical conclusion. Yes, this guy who incited an attack on our Capitol, this guy is going to protect us. This guy who's an adjudicated rapist, convicted felon, is going to protect us. This guy who went golfing and was tweeting while, you know, refrigerator trucks were filling up with the bodies of our fellow citizens, this guy's going to protect us. No one heard that and thought, yeah, you know, that's a pretty reasonable thing for him to say, unless they were already in that, in the cult. But what he was trying to do there, and what he always tries to do, is a couple of things, right? The gaslighting and who it might work on, but it's the distraction, right? That's really what it is, because now he knows, oh, they know I'm not, they don't think I'm going to protect them. Like, look, I took, you know, abortion away from them after 50 years. He knows that now, oh, look, they're talking about me saying this. So they're not talking about the fact that when asked about how I'm going to lower the price of childcare, I said, childcare is childcare, and started rambling incoherently about, honest to God, who knows what the with Marco Rubio and Ivanka. He knows that getting me fired up and getting all these other people with these big accounts and these big mouths out there talking about how he is a predator, not a protector, takes our minds and attention off the ball, which is that he is not offering any policy platforms or anything that is beneficial to any of us at all. And that, in fact, it'll be the opposite, that he really is a threat to democracy, and women would be far worse off. Anybody who needed protecting would be far worse off. But That's what he's doing when he says these incendiary things. He's really just trying to get us to look at the shiny outrage object over there and not at the fact that he's a bumbling idiot, convicted felon, adjudicated rapist, business fraud.
So let's talk about that, because you said something interesting, which was it's a distraction game. I agree with you 100%. And I think it really escalated after the debate when he knew in his lizard brain that he had failed miserably. And so now, yes, and not only do you have to distract, but also to your point about the bright, shiny, you know, outrage machine, it also puts him back in the spotlight, which is where he psychologically needs to be. Kamala Harris had kept him in shadow for the better part of 6 weeks, and it made him crazy. So yeah. He's always willing to do the most insane thing to get that attention. But as someone who has such a big microphone and such a big platform, how do you ensure that you are both acknowledging the insanity, acknowledging the fact that he's full of shit, but also bringing both yourself and your people back to center line about what really matters?
This has always been the tricky thing with Trump, right? I think people have struggled. The media has struggled mightily with this. I mean, people might say that it's more nefarious than struggle, but it's always been this line that you have to walk with him, where it's like, do you amplify him? Does that help him? You know, if you use his exact words, doesn't that just help him? And so there is sort of a double-edged sword there. But the way I personally navigate it is, you know, when I'm talking about his awfulness and his gaslighting and, you know, his record and what he represents and Project 2025, all of that stuff, I try to, as often as possible, contrast it with team sanity, you know, with team democracy, with the adult in the room, which is Kamala. You know, you just put those binary choices side by side. And you're talking about a former prosecutor versus, no offense to convicted felons, he's an unrepentant one, but versus a convicted felon. I mean, just that binary choice on its own. And then you take all those other things that you can line up where, you know, he is an idiot. She is an articulate woman. You know, he is insane. She's seemingly very sane. So I try to highlight the contrast as much as possible while also sort of identifying what a danger he represents in real terms. And I think that's like super important to do without amplifying him specifically at the same time.
Well, and I think there's another piece too that goes, I mean, Trump and MAGA are all about projection. If you know, they're doing it, they're going to say you're doing it. Right. But I want to talk about two things. One is Project 2025. Which is the base neo-fascistic blueprint for America's future, developed by the Heritage Foundation. Trump claims he has no idea about it, but you know, there's a guy videotaped in a hotel room saying, "Oh yeah, we knew he had to say this, but we'll all be there." He's, you know, pictures of the guy flying a plane with him. He was at the Heritage Foundation a couple of years ago saying, "Thank you for putting this plan together." But last night on cable television, a guy who even makes Trump look like less of a scumbag, a guy named Jason Miller, was asked about whether or not this pregnancy surveillance program would be national. And he said, no, it would be left up to the states. And so the idea here, one, that that's something that someone wrote in a plan is fundamentally anti-American, Joe. Secondly, that when asked the question, Miller didn't say that's ridiculous, we're not going to do it. He just leaned back on this whole idea of like, well, if a state wants to do it, they can do it.
Right. Well, I like to refer to him as he's basically the walking, talking, partially shaved scrotum. That's what he looks like to me. And remember that this guy put abortion medication in his girlfriend's smoothie. So,
right.
Jason Miller's special.
And is also a deadbeat dad for another woman who he worked with on the 2016 campaign. Yes.
Who hates my guts, by the way. Sorry. So he is a monster, but he's also a loser and a monster. And the thing that you're right, that's even in anything that would be a blueprint for the future is terrifying. But the thing also we have to remember is that so much of Project 2025 is actually implemented right now in states like Florida and Texas. They're sort of like proving grounds for a lot of these policies. Ron DeSantis has essentially proposed things like period trackers and, you know, menstrual cycle trackers and all of that other stuff. But Texas is implementing some of the most extreme abortion bans that Project 2025 is promising on a federal level. And if we want to talk about leave it up to the states, this was, abortion was left up to the states, and the red states like Texas. Texas got ahead of even Dobbs. So we have some longer, looking backward data to show us the impacts of these bans. So leaving up to the states, let's just talk about that first, because that, first of all, is not going to, would not be the case, especially with abortion. All of this stuff is intended to really be federal, so there won't be any safe havens. But in the state of Texas, where they've had an extreme abortion ban longer than any other state in this country, they now have data to show that the maternal mortality rates are up 56% since that ban went into place. Women are dying in that state from not being able to get for reproductive care at all, not being able to get a DNC or a procedure like that when they are miscarrying and there's fetal tissue remaining. They're dying and there's no more doctors in the state. This is a crisis, and that's leaving it up to the states, which, you know, they're perfectly fine. They're pro-life, but they're perfectly fine with that. They're perfectly fine with adult women who maybe in their with pregnancies they even wanted dying because they had the audacity to carry a fetus that was non-viable, and they won't help them. So, like, leaving it up to the states is, again, it's just sort of another shiny object that's not reflective of reality. But leaving it up to the states, like, if you leave it up to the red states, women will die. And also happening in red states, which is another part of Project 2025, are all these bans on the trans community and the LGBTQ plus community. And the transgender community in particular is suffering to such an extent because they can't get the medication that they need to survive that they're killing themselves. That's another data point that we have that was left up to the states. States like Oklahoma are essentially murdering the people who are transgender because they are refusing to provide them with the medication they need to survive. So Jason Miller, like, again, that's a little bit of gaslighting. He didn't even say that it was insane. Doesn't surprise me, but it is insane. And it's very reflective of the reality we would all be living under if, God forbid, Trump and Vance, who are the most anti-woman ticket probably in our history, were to take over the White House.
Well, and I would say this is that it's really antithetical to what the old Republican ideal was, which was that government was out of your personal life, that government was out of your business, that the idea was a limited but efficient government that did the things that government was supposed to do and really not much else.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think the expansion or rescission of government is an argument that we can have. But the point was, is that conservatives in America were not about legislating the bedroom. They were not about legislating a man in his castle. And I want to talk about that too, Joe, because, you know, the one thing that we found in our research at the Lincoln Democracy Institute, we talk about these guys called Dobbs dads, right? Like I am, right? I've got two daughters. Is that the thing that we see ourselves as first and foremost for our family, but our daughters in particular, is as their protector. And it would not surprise me if the Trump people have seen that in their survey research too, which is why they're using that language. But, you know, for me, you know, I live in a very red state. Do I want a bunch of goons in Salt Lake City telling me and my family what we have to do with some of the most personal, potentially difficult decisions in our lives? And it's one of those things where they want to tell you what you can and can't do or what your daughter can and can't do. But at the same time, you know, all the guns you want, right? Mm-hmm. You keep 1,000 guns in your house. We're not going to worry about that. But you got girls in your house, you know, we want to take a look at that. And I think to your other point about the health care is, I know that in states like Idaho and Louisiana, and it won't be long before this spreads, you know, OBGYNs are fleeing the state, right? Because there's too much liability. They're going against their conscience. Like, you know, you see some of these where there's, you know, if it's a Catholic medical system, right, they won't do the procedure necessary. It could be all you're talking about, a miscarriage. It could be an ectopic pregnancy, whatever the case might be. So I think it's also important to understand that when we talk about Project 2025 or these things, this is happening now.
Yeah.
Right. The poor woman who just died in Georgia. Right. These things are happening now. This is not prospective. This is not, here's what will happen if. I think it's important that we understand this is what's happening now. And I think to your point about quote unquote life, for Republicans, for MAGA, for Donald Trump, life is how they define it. How they define it, not how you define it, not how I define it, not how we collectively define it, but they get to decide what that word means, to whom it applies, and to whom it will be applied. and how it will be applied. And I think that's the other part too, which is antithetical to classical conservatism, which is individual liberty first and foremost. It all starts with that. If you can't be free, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom from religion, right? Then the rest of it doesn't matter, because that means that the trade that you've made with government, right, which is we will give you this authority in return for protection, for lack of a better way to put it, is now turned on its head, which is you've taken authority and you're refusing to protect us.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a party that wants to decide, you know, what books you can read, what words you can say, who you can love or marry, where you can travel to, what medications you can take, which surgeries you can have, what gender you are. You know, they want to control all of that. And then they will turn around and say that the libs are the ones who are coming for your freedom. As Tim Walz always says, and it's one of his best lines, I think it is so effective. Mind your own damn business. Mind your business. What are you doing in my bedroom? I don't want my local politician, my God, I don't want Tom Kane Jr. in my bedroom. No thanks. I don't want him in my doctor's offices. I don't want him in my kids' school libraries. I don't want him in my kids' doctor's appointments. And it's a very, like you said, it's a very strange thing, because I grew up with a Republican dad. I mean, I grew up, you know, with the ideals that you're talking about, that where the Republican Party was like kind of live and let live a little bit, not as much as, you know, a libertarian, but they were supposedly limited government, right? They didn't want to be in all those decisions. That wasn't really supposed to be their lane. And now everything is their lane, to the point where they're deciding when women can have families or not, whether we live or die because we get pregnant or not. They're deciding all of these things. And that's the other side of this too, which you were talking about, the Dobbs dads, and not this not being, you know, hypothetical. We don't have to guess anymore about the ramifications of these extreme abortion bans, because we're looking at them. We're looking at women going into hospitals with a non-viable fetus that they very much wanted and are devastated that they cannot carry anymore, that is killing them with sepsis. And their husbands are looking at them like, what's happening? And the doctors are going, you're going to have to go to another state. I can't help you. And I will fully confess to you that with all of the dystopian, you know, things I imagined being the reality under an abortion ban, I had never considered ectopic pregnancies being deadly in this way. I'd never considered, you know, a miscarriage being deadly in this way. And that's what's happening too to a lot of men, is that they're looking at their loved ones, they're looking at their daughters, their sisters, their wives, who are now being refused care and dealing with potentially dying because of these bans. And they're looking at doctors who are like, I don't want to go to jail. Or they're looking at deserts where their teenage daughter can't even go see a doctor at all because they don't exist. Or if they're in, God forbid, Florida, they basically have to go all the way up to Virginia with trillions of other people who are like in the South and going, where do I go? Who also have to go to Virginia. And those men never, I believe, I can't speak for them, but they probably never pictured this either. It's one thing to say like, oh, I don't need to worry about abortion. That'll never impact me. I'm a dude. Like, well, I'm not worried. My kids are fine. They're older. And it's another thing to be saying, oh my God, you could go into a hospital sick with sepsis because, you know, you tried to take medication abortion and something went wrong, and the doctors just look at you until your organs start failing and then decide, well, we should do something, and then it's too late. Like, I don't think a lot of people realized that that would also be part of this, but we now know that it is and will be. And so I think a lot of the Dobbs dads, to your point again, are like, okay, we thought this was outrageous before and we were sort of sitting on the sidelines, but this is way worse than we even imagined. And we don't want that world for our children or their children or our loved ones at all.
Right. And to your point too, about we should not at all leave out the hypocrisy of all this, which is if Greg Abbott, right, had a friend or a daughter who, God forbid, needed an abortion, like, they wouldn't be on the first plane to Los Angeles.
Right.
Right. Right. But if you live in San Saba, Texas, right, in the middle of, you know, West Central Texas, and you've got an ectopic pregnancy or you've miscarried, and again, you have to take care of the tissue, as you noted, right? You're going to drive to Louisiana? No. You're going to drive to Oklahoma? No.
Nope.
Okay. I guess you'll drive the 8 hours to New Mexico and hope you can find someone, right? Or an emergency room that'll take care of you. And I think that's the other part too, is for doctors too, I think this must be difficult, because, you know, for their whole thing is first do no harm, right? Yeah. They have an obligation if they see someone in mortal peril from a health perspective to try and fix them. And now they're being told, no, you're going to go to jail if you help this person. And so I think that's one reason too, why you're like, well, I'm not going to practice in Baton Rouge.
Right.
Right. I'll move to Denver. I'll move someplace else, because it's not like we're overloaded with doctors either, Joe, right? No. Like we're short of medical professionals as well.
And in the state of Texas, you can't even learn how to perform an abortion anymore. They won't even teach it. That's not something you, as a medical student, you can learn. So that's happening too, where these states are making it so that you can't even learn how to do these procedures in these, right, in these states. It's beyond maddening, the hypocrisy component to it, because I asked that question. I posed that question. I do this sometimes. I will ask MAGA a question. I'll ask Republicans a question. And I ask them what you just said. If it's you and it's your daughter or your sister or your wife who is facing what Amber Thurman faced in Georgia, and she went in there but like knowing she needed a DNC. I mean, they knew that she needed a DNC, and then they wait for 20 hours before helping her. And by then your loved one is in the throes of death. Like, what? That's what you support. Are you okay with that? And of course, none of them answered me. The ones that did said, that's not happening. That's not true.
Right.
But it is 1000% happening, and it is 1000% true. And we can't ignore that data. But there's also this other thing where this feels like a war on women to me so much, because not only is this like sort of advantageous to, you know, forcing birth or whatever it is, but now they're abusers, rapists and abusers are being able to impregnate women, and those women are being forced to carry those babies to term. I mean, think about, as a survivor myself, who did not, thank God, get pregnant, I cannot imagine having to walk through every day of my life, and it's not that child's fault, but it would be a constant re-traumatizing for me to know that the byproduct of this violent, horrible thing that happened to me was this living, breathing thing that I needed to facilitate the care of. I think that is cruelty on a level that is just inhumane. And also, what condition does a dude walk into an emergency room with where the doctors are like, I don't know, Reed. I don't know. I see that something's happening down there, and I just can't touch it. Yeah. I might go to jail. Right. No, that doesn't happen. So the hypocrisy on so many levels, the cruelty on so many levels, it's just, you said it right. It's antithetical to who we are. All of this is antithetical to who we are. And then they wrap themselves, they cloak themselves in religion, while being completely antithetical to the teachings of Jesus Christ. And that's the other side of this. It's like, Jesus would not be like, sorry, you're going to have to die because you're having a miscarriage. Like, that just, it's not like, I don't think that was a Jesus thing. But this is what they're doing.
No, it's a creepy sort of version of social Darwinism. Oh, well, you know, it was your time, right? But let me ask you this, because I want to talk about the abuse piece for a second. Because I know, my colleagues over at the American Sunlight Project, run by Nina Jankowicz, with, in all disclosure, I'm on the advisory board there, have done a study about women facing abuse on social media. And so as someone who has such a large presence and is so vocal out there, I don't want you to have to relive it, but just give the audience a taste of what it's like to be a proud, loud, proactive woman in politics on social media.
It is relentless, I'll say that. It used to upset me. It used to bother me. I used to take what they said personally, because they will go after anything they think that they can push. So it's always your looks, of course. But they will hyperanalyze every inch of my body, including my fingers, which they say are AI, which is crazy. Like, I just don't even imagine why I would AI my fingers. But for me, it's so bad that, like, Mark Hamill, when we met, like, that's me name dropping Reed, by the way.
Right.
When we met,
Luke Skywalker.
Like, yeah. I think he said something to the effect of, I think you're more hated than me on social media. Stephanie Miller, who's a good friend of mine, I posted a picture going to a show of hers, and she called me the next day because she said she went to look at the replies and she'd never seen anything like it. I mean, anything. They have created an entire mugshot and crafted a fake reality where I am a meth addict who has been arrested and lost even the right to see my kids, let alone, like, you know, have custody of them. There's all these fake realities, and it's all intended to just take me off of the ball, right? So that's the thing. It's horrible. It's vitriolic. It's evil. It's cruel. It's relentless. But I finally came to sort of this peace with it because I was like, oh, I don't care. Like, I've been through way too much in my life that's real, that has been hard, that I've triumphed over, to let some guy with seven numbers, an American flag, and an eagle in his name sitting in his basement pulling his pud take me off of my game because I need to accommodate his trolling crazy. Like, it's horrible. It is insidious. But we have a choice with everything in this world. I fundamentally believe that we have the choice to either take it in and let it impact us or just push it off and go, no, I'm sorry. That's not for me.
Well, and, you know, I'll tell you this. I think that, you know, we had this expression. I don't think we have it anymore. This idea of the concept of polite society, mm-hmm. right? That there were norms and basic rules that we followed from a social and behavioral aspect in order to get along with one another. Because yes, we all fight about everything, and I'm sure I have gotten into more ridiculous arguments over more small things than I could ever care to admit to. But the idea here was that we were supposed to live and let live, right? That was the idea. There's some level of at least attempting to find harmony amongst ourselves. And I think that's one thing, you know, people, you know, some of the MAGA people say have Trump derangement syndrome, like guilty as charged. Like, yeah. I do believe that as the leader of the country, as the leader of half the, you know, of the political party that represents roughly half the country, that his behavior, his amorality has had an effect on millions, mostly of American, especially white guys, right? Which is, you know, they're in a place of transition, both in their lives and generationally and economically and socially and culturally. And he has made it acceptable to be as big an asshole as you want to be to anybody all the time. And you probably face it more than anything, because as you said, with these guys with the one name and the numbers and the eagle and the whatever, you know, there's this anonymity that comes along with it too, which is they feel no sanction for it. And in their little world, right, in their dark mom's basement, it gives them some sense of power that they type this nasty thing to JoJo from Jurors. And that's one of those things that's also like, guys, we need to be better, right? Like, American men are, like, they're dying younger, more deaths of despair. But, like, if, again, going back to that whole basis of conservatism, Joe, like, if personal responsibility is one of the tenets of conservatism, then guys, like, we got to be responsible for our behavior, right? Like, you can't just say, well, I don't like her, so I'm going to go say these horrible things, or if I ever saw you, I'd do X, Y, and Z, right? That's not okay. And I'll just tell you this. I mean, in California years ago, there was this blacked out Range Rover, and I've told this story before, right? Probably $150,000 car. Black paint job, blacked out windows, black wheels. And on the bumper sticker, it says, don't tread on me. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, Joe, this guy's never been tread on in his life.
Right.
Right. But here he is. He feels put upon, not because he's economically disadvantaged or socially or culturally disadvantaged, but for the sin, Joe, of somebody asking him to just be decent.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is one of the sort of the secret sauce of MAGAism and Trump is it's this, and I hate overusing this term, but it is sort of this permission structure, and I hate overusing that term to not have accountability for anything in your life that might be wrong, right? So like, you can, it's kind of this perfect magic stew of like grievance, a lack of accountability, right, being able to blame someone else, you know, projection, all of those things. So you take somebody, that guy probably had a small dick, right? So like, he's got a big truck and whatever and a funny sticker, but like, he probably has a tiny penis. And so that guy is walking around with, you know, tiny peen, and he's like, it's not my fault that I have a tiny penis. It's the immigrant's fault that I have a tiny penis. And I'm not saying he's thinking those things out loud, but let's just say this subconsciously, like, that's the thing. What Charlie Kirk and Donald Trump and Ben Shapiro and Tim Pool and all of them, they give these totally unexceptional white dudes who can't like get laid naturally this permission structure that it's not really their fault. Like, it's like, it's because women are woke and men are no longer masculine. And it's the irony of them being like, you know, uber masculine, Ben Shapiro and his 2x4, but it's that, right? So it's all of that, which is like, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. And grievance, and everything is under threat when nothing is under threat, and you can go out and get your own, right? But also emboldening the worst of us, those things that like we used to be, like you said, we used to feel ashamed of those dark thoughts. I'm not saying, you know, I thought them. I'm just saying those people who thought the horrible things we hear out loud and see all the time on display used to have some sense of shame. It used to be that polite society would shun that sort of stuff, that it wasn't accepted. What Donald Trump and MAGA do is they say, you guys think all these things, you know, where you didn't get that job and you blame those other people who took that job when that not isn't reflective of reality. Like now you're right to call them all those awful names. You're right to spread lies about them eating cats and dogs. You're right to want to deport them, even if they're here legally. You're right to blame them for all the ills in your unremarkable life. And that's a really powerful drug that you can't easily sort of pull back, because you once told me when we talked on my podcast about these constant hits of dopamine that they get all the time, right, where like Fox and those other channels kind of hit them all the time with like grievance and hate and blame and rage and all that stuff, that you, it's really hard to pull that back from people once they're hooked. They're addicted. They need it more and more and more. And then you give them guns, et cetera. Right. And it's, yeah, it's a mess. But I think the grievance component is, it's, they're such whiny babies.
Well, but I'll tell you, I mean, I want to talk about that just for a second, because we forget, and I mentioned this just a few minutes ago, it's been 9 years of this,
yeah,
but it's been 50 years before that of laying the groundwork for it, of, you know, look, I mean, there's that infamous video of Lee Atwater, who was George H.W. Bush's campaign manager in 1988, saying, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we could say N-word, N-word, N-word. In the 70s, it wasn't okay. In the 80s, we called them welfare queens. You know, then it was critical race theory, right? There's always a scare the white people component to it.
Yeah.
But then they added in, not only should you be scared, you should be angry. Oh, and by the way, you know, you're not that tough, right? I mean, there was this picture the other day, Joe, of these two really overweight guys, older overweight guys, I think at a Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
And they're both in camouflage. They're both in like flak jackets, and they're both carrying AR-15s to a Chick-fil-A. Like, and I wrote on Twitter, like, these guys actually need serious help. Like, it's not funny. Like, it's funny because the imagery is so patently ridiculous to otherwise normal people. But these guys made the proactive decision. I don't know if they live together. I don't know if they live separately, but Bob, get your gear on. We got to go to Chick-fil-A and get a spicy chicken and a large fries and a large sweet tea, but strap up, right? Like, that's not normal human social behavior.
No, but they're overcompensating for a whole lot of other things, right? Like that AR-15 strapped to their, you know, font is making them feel powerful in a world where they are constantly fed, you know, messages that they are insignificant and unimportant. So if they walk into, you know, a restaurant where they probably made the chicken nuggets with something like an AR-15, because it basically purees anything it hits, like, that makes them feel powerful when nothing else in the universe could.
Because they want to see the reaction of people. They want to see people back away. They want to see people concerned, because that, you know, it's that infamous LBJ quote, every man a king who has someone to look down on. Okay. Look, I've kept you too long, but I do, before I let you go, I want to ask one other question. So, I'm attending a polling briefing yesterday by an allied group, and Joe, not surprisingly, their results across the electoral college states, neck and neck. Everything is still really, really close between Vice President Kamala Harris and convicted felon Donald Trump. What do you think is going on? Why is that? What do you think? Is it, again, that we've been at this a decade? Is it that, you know, you have the MAGA believers and then you've got the rest of the Republicans who've just believed that, you know, Democrats are Marxists and Kamala Harris is, you know, Barack Obama's secret sister from Kenya? Like, what is it?
A communist comrade. I went to a town hall last night here in my county to see my Democratic candidate for Congress. And there were a few people there who were Republican and they were older. And I was trying to answer that question for myself, because I ask like myself that question all the time. I believe I've even asked you that question, because it's one that it's a mystery to me. But I think, unfortunately, that for whatever reason, whether it's Fox News or anything else, I think that there's some disconnect from reality that is pervasive in society at large. I mean, we saw it with, you know, Joe Biden's accomplishments not getting any attention anywhere ever, you know, and I think when you couple that with, you know, inflation, where people don't understand that, they don't understand the origins of it, they don't understand, all they care about is how much are my eggs, how much is my gas, how much is my rent, how much is my mortgage. You couple all of that with, you know, the constant bombardment of lies and propaganda, and people sort of don't know which end is up. They don't know what to believe. And a lot of people believe the wrong things. And then they have those conversations with their friends and et cetera. So I think that's part of the it's a muck for sure, but that's part of it. And I think that there's an antidote to that. I think that there's a way to break through. And that is the conversations with my congressional candidate sat down with that guy for a very long time. After so long, I didn't get to talk to her. I left after like 40 minutes. She wanted to talk to him. And those kind of conversations person to person, where you can actually sort of dispel a lot of these lies and this mythology, and you can actually have these, this is reality, this is why prices might be high, this is what we can do about it. Like those kind of conversations, I think they're the antidote to a lot of this stuff that is a breakdown in what's happening and versus what people are perceiving. But I also don't put a lot of trust or stock in polls. I just think when faced with the binary choice at the end of the day, I think as you know, so many people have said, what MAGA and what Trump are selling is grievance. It's anger, it's hate, it's vitriol, it's division, it's the worst of us. And I don't think the American people are in that market anymore. I just don't think we're buying it.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. All right, Joe, before we let you go, where I know that most of the people listening either know who you are or have already found you as they're listening, but where can we find all of your good work online?
Oh, thank you for asking that. And I am on Substack, which is my baby. I'm very proud of my Substack. That's Are You Effing Kidding Me on Substack. I also have my Are You Effing Kidding Me podcast. I like to swear, as we said. On the socials, I'm still on Twitter. I still call it Twitter. JoJo from Jurz on all the other socials except for Instagram and Threads, which there's a JoJo.FromJurz. And I think that's it for now. I'm working on some really big stuff, I think. So keep an eye out for that. If you're curious, just follow me and check it out. But that's where you can find me.
Awesome. As always, gang, you can find me on Twitter and TikTok at Reed Galen, on Instagram and Threads at Reed_GalenUSA, and also at Substack, also the home front. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Reed. This was so much fun.
And everybody else, we'll see you next time.